great. But we're looking at this passage, Revelation chapter 21, and the first 8 verses. One of the deepest desires that we find in our hearts is the desire for home. Home, sweet home, we might say. I feel right at home. Home. It's one of the most deeply rooted desires that we find in our hearts, to have somewhere we know we belong. One writer goes so far as to say this. He says that to destroy the concept of home is to destroy humanity itself. Home, according to the Bible, is a place where we flourish. It's a place where we flourish spiritually. It's a place where we flourish physically. It's a place where we flourish socially, in relationships. It's a place where we know a true rest. It's one of the deepest longings that we experience, the longing for home. Yet we never feel like we're there. We've never quite made it. Home eludes us. And our experience of Christmas, I think, tends to remind us of this. Our homes, ordinarily, are the center of our Christmases, aren't they? Everything will revolve around the home over the next few weeks, if we were in an ordinary time. Hosting family and friends, homely traditions, hanging up stockings, opening presents, food, laughter. Yeah, there's always something missing. Of course, there's something missing this year, when a lot of these things can't happen as we would want them to. But there's something missing on any ordinary year too. Isn't it at Christmas that we feel most acutely the loss of our loved ones? You know, at home, for many people this Christmas, there's an empty seat where a loved one once sat. A parent, a child, a spouse. And so home feels incomplete. There's something missing, someone missing. And isn't it also at Christmas that we wish we could just stop time? That we're loving being at home with family and friends so much. It's this kind of festive haven away from our normal daily lives, and we wish we could just stop the clock and make it last forever. But it comes to an end, and our festive haven gives way once again to our daily repeat. Something's missing. Our longing for home is still there, unsatisfied. How is that longing going to be met? What will satisfy our desire for home? Now, the book of Revelation was written for people who knew what it was to long for home. We know that it was written to a group of people at a time when Christians in the Roman Empire were persecuted. We know that it was written at a time when many people in churches were spiritually apathetic or indifferent towards God. They weren't satisfied by God. They weren't at home with him. We know that it was written at a time when some churches had become tolerant of false teaching. They weren't rooted in the truth. And all of these things are things that unsettle. Persecution unsettles. Tolerating false teaching unsettles. Revelation was written for people like this, for people who weren't, you might say, truly home. And what does Jesus, through his apostle John, the writer of Revelation, give these people? Part of what he gives them is Revelation 21, which is a vision of the future home for the Christian. He's writing to encourage unsettled Christians. He's writing to wake up sleepy Christians. He's writing to wake up spiritually apathetic non-Christians. And to do that, what does he do? He writes about the future home for the Christian, the future home that awaits all of God's people. Do you see that in these first few verses that we read in Revelation 21? In verse 1, John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, a new home he's talking about. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. There was no longer any sea, and I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. A new heaven and a new earth, a new home. The holy city, the new Jerusalem, prepared as a bride. This is a picture of God's people. A new home with God's people coming down from heaven to dwell in it. How can we know what it is to be truly home? How will this longing of our hearts be satisfied? Well, we need a vision of our future home. So I want us to see three things this morning. I want us to see, first of all, what this future home will be like. Secondly, who will be there in this future home? And thirdly, how this future home will should affect our lives now. What it's like, who's there, and how it affects us now. First of all, what's this future home like? You know, it's everything that our hearts long for. You see that in the description of John's vision in these verses. In verse 1, he sees the first heaven and the first earth have passed away. What does that mean? It means that what he goes on to record in verse 4. He says in verse 4, there in the new heaven and new earth, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Isn't that a description of some of the deepest yearnings that you experience? Don't you long for there to be no more death? Don't you long for there to be no more mourning? Aren't you far more acquainted with grief than you ever hoped you would be? Aren't your loved ones far more acquainted with grief than you ever hoped they would be? No more crying, no more pain. It's everything you wish your home could be now. One of the things that has become tradition, hasn't it, at Christmas in our country is to watch a good film on Christmas Eve, on Christmas Day, Boxing Day. You might buy the Radio Times and you might browse what's going to be on, and you might pull out one of your favourite DVDs or a new DVD, if you still do DVDs, or you might have something on iTunes or Netflix or one of the other streaming platforms. And one of the films that's often on over Christmas is one of the Lord of the Rings films. I'm not a huge Lord of the Rings fan, but there's a description of something in Tolkien's book, The Hobbit, which is really illustrative of what we're talking about here. It's his description of the place Rivendell. You don't have to be a Lord of the Rings fan to understand something about Rivendell. Rivendell for Tolkien is the perfect home. It's where Elrond lives with all the elves. I don't know what you think about elves, but in this book, in Tolkien's story, they're good guys. And Elrond's house in Rivendell is called the Last Homely House. Whenever Bilbo or whoever arrives at the Last Homely House, Tolkien writes in such a way as to make us think, oh, wow, what a description. What a place. And when Bilbo arrives at Elrond's house for the first time in The Hobbit, Tolkien writes this. He says, his house was perfect. Whether you liked food or sleep or work or storytelling or singing or just sitting and thinking best, or a pleasant mixture of them all, evil things did not come into that valley. And towards the end of the book, when Bilbo's on his way home from his adventure, he stops at Elrond's house again, and Tolkien writes, weariness fell from him soon in that house. And he had many a merry jest and dance early and late with the elves of the valley. Evil things did not enter Rivendell. Weariness soon left Bilbo when he arrived there. It's so appealing, isn't it? It's almost like a mirage, but it's not. not for the Christian, because the future home that awaits the Christian is Rivendell-esque. Tears wiped away, no more death, no more mourning, no more crying, no more pain. Home, as it should be, as we so desperately want it to be, as it one day will be for the Christian. Here in this future home, God will reverse the curse that we have all lived under since Adam and Eve fell in Genesis 3. Tears, death, mourning, crying, pain, all of that is the result of Genesis 3, the result of sin entering the world and causing such fractures in our creation and in our lives. But in this home to come, all these things will be removed. The curse will be removed, and we will be truly home. In fact, the very reason that we long for home so much is right there in what I've just said. Why is it that we have this desire that just we cannot seem to satisfy? It's because we were made for a home that is different to the world as we now live in it. We were made for Eden. We were made for the perfect creation of Genesis 1 and 2, for the place where we would know unhindered fellowship with God himself, unhindered unity and harmony with the rest of creation. This is what J.R.R. Tolkien once wrote elsewhere. He once wrote a letter to his son, Christopher, and he said this. He said, "We all long for Eden, and we are constantly glimpsing it. Our whole nature, at its best and least corrupted, its gentlest and most humane, is still soaked with the sense of exile. If you come to think of it, your very just horror at the stupid murder of the hawk, that is the senseless killing of the hawk, and your obstinate memory of this home of yours in an idyllic hour, when often there is an illusion of the stay of time and decay and sense of gentle peace, all of that is derived from Eden," Tolkien wrote. What he's saying is this. He's saying we long for a home that we can never seem to find. We see that because we see that something is wrong with the world. And we know that because even when we look back at a previous memory that we're fond of, a place, a certain point in our lives that we would like to get back to, if we do ever get the opportunity to recreate that memory or to revisit that place, it's never as good as we remembered it to be. The memory wasn't as satisfying as we remembered it to be. The place wasn't as beautiful. The place wasn't as idyllic as we remembered it to be. Now, why is this the case? Because we all long for a sense of Eden, Tolkien says. And we're all soaked in a sense of exile. We know that we're not at home and we want to get home. And here is that very home that we long for so much in Revelation 21. A place of tranquility and peace, a refuge and a stronghold away from evil. Evil doesn't enter this valley. That's what the future home for the Christian is like. Secondly, I want us to see who will be there. You know, this is really the main point of the passage. John wants us to see that this future home is only truly home because God is there with his people. Now, verse 3 is really the centerpiece of the passage, the centerpiece of the vision. Verse 3 says, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and will be their God." And the dwelling of God is with man. He will live with them. God himself will be with them. Three times John states this. He really wants us to get this. And this future home for the Christian, God himself is with his people, dwelling with them, living with them. His people knowing his presence without hindrance, without interruption for eternity. This is what makes this future home, home. Some of you might be familiar with the singer-songwriter Jack Johnson. I love Jack Johnson's music. There's several albums that you could listen to. On one of his albums, Sleep Through the Static, he sings a song called Angel. And it's a song about his wife and his children. And there's a line when he's singing about his wife where he says this. He says, "You give me presents with your presence alone." See what he's saying? He's saying, "You give me presents with a T, with your presence with a C alone." He's saying to his wife, "The best thing about being married to you is that I'm with you all of the time. Your present to me, your gift to me, is your presence with me." Well, God's gift to us, his greatest gift to us, is his presence with us. That is what makes this future home, home. And we all know, don't we, that home isn't primarily a house or a place. Where we live is certainly part of what makes up our home, but the most fundamental ingredients of our home are the relationships, the people who you live with, who you love. And this relationship, God's relationship with his people, is precisely the thing that banishes tears, death, mourning, crying, pain. You see that in verse 4. John writes that he, God, will wipe away every tear from their eyes. God himself will do that. It's one of the most intimate pictures we have of God's love for his people in the whole of the New Testament. It's a picture of God himself making his way around all his people, putting his arm around them, comforting them, and one by one, wiping away their tears. And by his presence with us, banishing everything that would ever be the cause of more tears in the future. And so do you see God's desire to be with his people? Now this is at the heart of everything that we celebrate at Christmas, isn't it? This is what we read, what we read at this time of year from Matthew chapter 1, where we read that Jesus is Emmanuel. He is God with us. God created us for relationship with himself. He created us to be with him. We have rejected him and we have fled, but he has come after us in the most loving of ways. He has come after us in the person of his son, Jesus Christ, Emmanuel. And so do not doubt, friends, God's desire to be with you, to draw near to you, and to comfort you. In the future home for the Christian, God is there. That's what makes this home, home. What this home is like, who will be there? But before I move on, I want you to note who won't be there, who will not be there. God is there with his people, but those who are not his people, those who do not belong to him, they will not be there. This home is not theirs to look forward to. It's what we see in verses 5 to 8. John says, "And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of water of life. He who overcomes will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death.'" This home that we've been speaking about, this home that the Bible speaks about, the home that will satisfy our every longing, is not the end destination for everyone. Those who do not belong to God will not arrive at this home. And the contrast in the passage is between those who are sons of God at the end of verse 7 and those who are defined by this list that we find in verse 8. The list isn't an exhaustive list. It's not the be-all and end-all. It is simply a list of different sinful actions and behaviors which, when all is said and done, still define those who don't belong to God. You see, God is not saying here in this passage that Christians, those who will one day arrive at this home, are never cowardly. Sometimes we are. God is not saying here that Christians never struggle with unbelief. Sometimes we do. God is not saying here that Christians never give themselves to anger, to murder in their hearts. Sometimes we do. God is not saying here that Christians are always sexually pure, because sometimes we are not, and so on. No, the difference here is one of identity. The Christian's identity, who they are, is summed up at the end of verse 7, when John says that as God says, he will be my son. See, the Christian may at times struggle with cowardice, with anger, with sexual sin, with a whole host of other sins. But these things do not ultimately define who he or she is. He or she is a son of God. And as a son, he or she will inherit this home. But the person who isn't a Christian, the person who isn't a follower of Jesus Christ, they don't have this identity. And so they do not share in this inheritance. They will not inherit this home prepared for God's people. The identity of the person who doesn't belong to God is found in what they do. And that is never good news. Cowardice, unbelief, murder, sexual immorality, and so on. These things the Bible teaches us are not only external to us, but they're internal. You may never have committed murder, but moments of hatred in your heart show that you're certainly capable of it if God were to take away all restraints from you. These people that this list are describing, they're defined by what they do. This is the great divide. Humanity before God is split into two groups of people. Those who are defined by what Jesus Christ has done, and those who are defined by what they themselves do. On which grounds would you prefer to stand before God? Would you prefer to stand before him defined by the sinless life of Jesus Christ? Or would you prefer to stand before him defined by what you have done? Only those who are defined by Jesus Christ will inherit this home that we so long for. And so you see, the only alternative for the unbeliever, the only alternative is to fail to inherit the home that we so long for. That means permanent exile, permanent homelessness, never knowing that longing for home to be satisfied. What a horrible prospect. But it doesn't have to be that way. It can be different. This theme of home, it runs right the way through the Bible's Christmas narrative. The Son of God left his home in heaven. He left his Father's side. He came into this world as a stranger and an exile. He was hunted and he was without a home here on earth. He came to his own people and they did not receive him. He once said, "Foxes have holes, birds have nests." But he had nowhere to lay his head. He was rejected. And when it came to his death, the book of Hebrews makes the point that he was crucified outside of the city. He was treated as an exile, crucified as an exile. Why? Why was this the case? He was exiled so that you could come home. He was rejected so that you could be received. This future home Revelation 21 holds out to us can belong to you if you'll come to Jesus and receive him by faith. He was exiled so that you could come home. Firstly, what is this future home like? Secondly, who will be there? Thirdly, finally, really briefly, what difference should this make to our lives now? Well, we know from the letters to the churches in the beginning of Revelation that John is writing to three main groups of people. He's writing to those who are spiritually apathetic, spiritually indifferent, and Christians who have just become lethargic and, you might say, lazy in their faith, and also non-Christians who aren't taking seriously spiritual things, the message that they're hearing. He's also writing to Christians who are putting up with false teaching in their churches and in their communities. And he's also writing to those who are being persecuted, those who are suffering. He's writing then to those who are spiritually lazy, those who do not care enough for the truth, those as well who are suffering, those three groups of people. And this vision of the future home for the Christian speaks into each of those contexts. This home, this home that is everything that our hearts long for because God is there, how does that affect us now? Well, it ought to wake the spiritually lazy up to seek God, because we see that only he will satisfy the deepest longings of our hearts. Nothing else will do it. Whatever else you might chase after, whatever else you might look to fill that void, it won't work. It won't satisfy. Only God will satisfy that longing that we know. It ought to make those who aren't too interested in standing up for the truth serious about standing up for the truth, because those who don't know and accept the truth about Jesus Christ will not inherit this home. It ought to comfort those who are suffering, because it reveals to us that we can know a taste of this home to come now through fellowship with God. This home will be home because he is there, and we can know him with us now as we walk with him and enjoy fellowship with him. And it also ought to comfort those who are suffering as they realize that life will not always be as it is now. One day, the curse will be totally removed and evil will be banished. No evil will come into that valley. And weariness will soon leave us in our future home.